Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We go from Thailand to Canada on the program today. Superfoods to payphones. So much to talk about, so very little time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 22nd of May today. For the second time in a decade, the Thai army has overthrown the government there and put itself in charge. The generals who did so said they were acting, and this is a quote, in order to reform the political structure, the economy, and the society. We've got the BBC's Jonathan Head on the line from Bangkok to talk about that middle part, the already troubled Thai economy. Jonathan, good to speak with you.
Hi, good evening.
First of all, what's it like out there? What does it look like on the streets?
Well, there's a curfew in place. It's kept it pretty quiet. I think things have been so tense for so long that for some people in Bangkok, it's almost a relief. But there's also some shock that this has happened, because for many, many months now, the army has said it doesn't think a coup can solve Thailand's problems. And those who oppose a coup here, the so-called red shirt supporters of the government, have said they would resist any kind of coup or takeover like this, possibly with force.
The State Planning Agency came out just on Monday and said the Thai economy is already in recession. It contracted 2% the first quarter of this year. I can't imagine that this is going to help anything along those lines for the regular people of Thailand.
Not at all. I mean, Thailand's economy is often called a Teflon economy because it's managed to ride out all the extraordinary political turmoil of the last 8 years relatively unscathed. A lot of the businesses that really drive Thailand's economy are based outside of Bangkok, and they will carry on as normal. And the army has made it clear it doesn't want to chase people away. It wants things to carry on as normal. The things that Thailand is good at, its exports, manufacturing, its cars, its electronics, will continue as normal. Where there are real worries, I think, is that because of this long crisis, big investment decisions have been delayed. And the political uncertainty is putting off foreign direct investors too. We've already had a number of postponements of potentially big factory constructions and big investments. In the weeks ahead, there may be some real nervousness among investors.
I'm not hearing you say anything that would make me, as a tourist, want to get on a plane and hit Chiang Mai or Bangkok or the beaches of southern Thailand.
Tourists will have to reconsider coming here. I mean, to be honest, those tourists here won't really be affected. Yeah. The beaches are unaffected. Even in most of Bangkok, people won't see much of what's going on. And I think the new military rulers will do their very best to make sure things are fine for tourists. For example, they're stressing that although there's a curfew, tourists will be able to drive late at night to the airport and back. But in the end, the element of uncertainty about whether there will be conflict, you know, that sort of thing is really going to put tourists off. Everything depends on how the military handles things now and on how much resistance they face as to whether tourists start reconsidering their holiday bookings.
Acknowledging that it's early days yet, can people still go to the market and get daily supplies? Are there people just out and about?
I think it'll be fine. I mean, the first full day of military rule will be tomorrow morning. Yeah. I think people will be going to work as normal. I think the worry really is, what are the long-term intentions of the military? When they took over in the last coup in 2006, the country was a lot less polarized. They faced very little resistance. And yet they were accused then of completely mismanaging the economy and of actually making the divide in Thai politics even worse. Now they're doing it again, even though the army commander, General Prayut, has frequently said beforehand he doesn't think that a coup would really work. They've done it now. They're going to have to try to manage the country in far less favorable circumstances, with consumer demand already collapsing, with a lot of people very indebted after a bit of a consumer binge in recent years. That could all make it very, very tricky for the army.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Bangkok. Thanks very much.
Good to talk to you.
Markets-wise, currency traders didn't seem to care too much about the coup. The Thai baht barely budged. Wall Street could not have cared less. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With this morning's corporate profit report of note, that is the one from Sears, saying it lost more than $400 million last quarter, comes this question. What is it with Canada, man? Sears Canada saw its biggest sales losses in 5 years. And just the other day, Target fired the head of its Canadian operations after losing nearly $1.5 billion on its Canadian stores. Walmart and Lowe's have struggled up there as well. So Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports now on why so many U.S. retailers find it's grim up north.
Canada. It's basically just America with colder winters and an ice hockey obsession, right?
We are different. People forget that we are different in terms of how we buy.
Debbie Andrus teaches marketing at the University of Calgary.
We buy the same items and we're still looking for value, but we have different purchasing behaviors.
Take Target. It charged into Canada last year, opening more than 100 stores. Sounds like overreach, maybe, but Target was already popular with Canadians who had been crossing the border to shop at its stores for years. Brian Yarbrough is an analyst with financial services firm Edward Jones. He says it wasn't exactly arrogance, but
there was too much complacency that they thought you can go up to Canada and we can open these stores just like they are in the U.S. and people are just going to flock to stores.
Yarbrough says part of the problem was Target tried to stock its Canadian stores the same way it stocked those in the U.S. Bad move.
We have financial advisors up in Canada, and I get these calls, and like, it's the middle of October, and it's winter up here already, and they don't even have gloves in their stores.
And Canadian retailers upped their game in anticipation of Target coming to Canada, lowering prices, stepping up marketing. But there was one notable exception, says the University of Calgary's Debbie Andrus. Sears.
Sears Canada, however, weren't changing as the other Canadian retailers were changing with the other American companies coming in.
And Canada's a competitive market, says Andrus. Although the country's huge, its population is relatively small. There are 35 million Canadians, compared with more than 300 million Americans. And there are only so many loonies to go around. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There were some numbers out today from the Census Bureau about cities specifically and where American cities are growing. The short answer to that question is Texas. Conventional wisdom says a bigger population leads to a stronger economy, yes. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports, sometimes the conventional wisdom is stupid.
The Census Bureau says 7 of the top 15 fastest-growing cities are in Texas. They're clustered around big oil and gas boom towns like Dallas and Houston, or tech hubs like Austin. Sometimes population equals prosperity.
They go hand in hand.
Luis Betancourt studies cities at the Santa Fe Institute. He says the newbies bring their wallets, and their spending adds to economic growth.
You add a person, and you get more money per capita.
That's pretty much true in Texas. Income growth in the fast-growing suburbs of Austin is high because of the types of jobs there. But Betancourt says there are caveats. This past decade wrecked all the economic models. The housing bubble was making people move, says Robert Puentes at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program.
There was cheap housing that was available, and the actual construction of that housing created jobs.
But some economists say even without the housing bubble, the theory that growth begets growth is off. Paul Gottlieb is an economist at Rutgers. He says, look at Las Vegas. People are moving there for jobs.
Naturally, if there's a lot of hiring, you would expect people to migrate in. But the jobs have not necessarily been very high paying.
Gottlieb says, sure, you have new people and new jobs, but they don't have fat wallets. They don't bring growth and prosperity. Gottlieb says in some big northeastern cities, income is rising much faster than population, and that's not a bad thing. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
It's entirely possible that you are by now sick and tired of hearing about the virtues of superfoods. Kale and blueberries, Brussels sprouts and salmon. Foods so nutritious they are often said to be life-changing. They are often also fads. Anybody remember acai out there? Yes, it is a very first world problem, I know. But in a sense, similar things are happening in the developing world as well. Certain crops are being touted as panaceas to help alleviate hunger and poverty. But as Dan Bobkoff explains, it doesn't always work out that way.
I reached Rosie Kabantek by phone on her farm.
I'm Rosie Kabantek, farmer of Moringa here in the Philippines.
Her farm is in Pangasinan, a northwestern province. It's an area known for rice, but a few years ago she started adding a tree called Moringa. She heard about its potential. Nearly every part from roots to flowers is edible or thought to be medicinal.
Good for your body.
Good for your body. Also good medicine. Also good for money.
She says her monthly income doubled since she added about 2.5 acres of moringa trees to her farm. Moringa is one of many of these so-called superfoods. There's the grain amaranth, the smelly jackfruit, trendy quinoa, even mung bean, to name just a few. If only farmers planted more of these, proponents say, we could alleviate hunger and poverty around the world.
One tree can change a family's life for generations.
This is Josh Schneider. He's managing partner at Global Breadfruit. It's a company trying to get farmers to replace some staple crops with breadfruit trees. The fruit is more like a potato and can be made into French fries and flour, gluten-free, of course.
This is something that tropical farmers can dominate this market, and it can really help grow their economies and lift these countries up out of poverty.
And this gets at one of the biggest debates in international agriculture. On one side, you have people like Schneider, who believe that the secret to reducing hunger is to promote new and niche crops. On the other, you have skeptics like William Masters.
People need to find the bright new thing to chase after.
Masters is chairman of the Food Nutrition Policy Department at Tufts. He says more often than not, so-called miracle crops like moringa or breadfruit are distractions.
Why is it that it didn't get identified as a huge success previously?
In other words, it's not like farmers haven't tried many of these crops before. Farmers experiment. They'll plant something new and see how it does. And over the years, many of these so-called superfoods failed for the most mundane of reasons. They take too long to grow, require too much labor, or are prone to pests. It's not as easy to spread breadfruit as wheat.
That search across all the available biodiversity has been going on for thousands of years, and it's led to a system that has found a half dozen or dozen major species that feed the world, and that's because those major species have some pretty amazing characteristics.
You know these, wheat, corn, rice, and the like. Governments, foundations, and colleges should spend their money and time improving what farmers are already growing, he says. That's not to say a niche crop can't ever explode and become a big part of the world's diet. Soybeans used to be regional, but in the last century, changes in breeding made it possible to grow them all over. All of this comes down to economics. Do these new crops have a market, both at home and for export? Will fads lead crops to rise and fall? Moringa may be about to have its moment, winding up in teas and even bath gels. That's partly why Rosie Cabantuk, the farmer in the Philippines, is so excited.
Eat more moringa.
Eat more moringa.
Plant more moringa.
Plant more moringa. And that's it.
But even so, she isn't betting the farm on moringa. Most of her acres still grow a boring old staple, rice. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Coming up.
I actually love the smell of a filthy payphone.
Ah, New York, greatest city in the world, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials eked out a 10-point gain today. We'll call that less than a 10%. Finished at 16,543. The NASDAQ added 22 points, about a half percent, 4,154. At the bell, the S&P 500 rose 4 points. That is 0.2%, 1,892. There are reports of a merger between Lorillard and Reynolds American. Didn't exactly light up the tobacco company's share. Lorillard, home to Newport Menthols, fell 5%. Reynolds and Joe Camel dropped 2%. Altria, I suppose, which dominates the U.S. market with Marlboro's, edged up a 10%. Williams-Sonoma gained revenue as consumers spent more on cool kitchen stuff and furniture. Williams-Sonoma owns Pottery Barn in West Elm as well. Shares whipped up 8% today. Hess Corporation is selling all its retail stores to Marathon Petroleum, which will make Marathon's Speedway the nation's biggest convenience store chain. Hess rose 1.1%. Marathon slipped about 0.9% on that news. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.55%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. We'll learn the numbers of new homes sold last month. On this day in 1934, famed fugitives Bonnie and Clyde were taken down by police after a 2-year crime spree. The movie was released 3 decades later. And did you know that turtles have been on the Earth for more than 200 million years? They evolved before mammals, crocodiles, and even lizards. Happy International World Turtle Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace from 8 p.m. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Unless you are an exceptionally dedicated cook, I'm going to guess that if you open up your pantry right now, somewhere on the shelves in there is probably a jar of pasta sauce, of red sauce. And to go just a little bit further out on a limb or farther out on a limb, I will guess that there's a pretty good chance it says Ragu on it. I can say that because Ragu is the number one pasta sauce brand in this country. It's owned by Unilever. But not for too much longer. Ragu is being sold to the Japanese food company Mizcon for a hair over $2 billion. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the details.
Back in 1937, if you wanted to buy Ragu pasta sauce, you would have had to buy it out of the trunk of a car from its creators, a married couple named Giovanni and Assunta Cantisano. Back then, pasta and red sauce was not a staple of the American diet like it is today.
It didn't happen overnight, but sometimes these things can. Again, you're trying to change people's perception of what's appropriate to have for dinner.
Len Lodish is a professor of marketing at the Wharton School. As American attitudes about Italian immigrants changed, Italian food became popular, and Americans' perception of Italian food was built on tomato sauce. Ragu was a big part of that.
Ragu home style is good enough to call homemade.
They might even like it better than mine.
Ragu home style spaghetti sauce. That's Italian.
Ragu is the number one pasta sauce in the U.S., but sales are down 18% since 2009 as more shoppers turn to private label sauces. This could be one reason Unilever is selling Ragu to the Japanese company Mizcon.
Hello, and welcome to Mizcon, a world leader in the manufacture of liquid condiments.
Mizcon is the largest producer of vinegar in the world, along with other food products that, according to the company's website, are revered throughout the world for bringing flavor to life.
Bringing flavor to life is a registered trademark of the Mizcon Corporation.
Overall, the food industry is a slow growth market, says Harry Balzer, chief industry analyst with the NPD Group.
So if you're looking for high growth, food is a tough place. It's going to be a market share bet.
If Mizcon wants to grow Ragu's market share, says Balzer, it will have to take it away from a competing sauce. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Earlier this month, Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, announced a plan to turn some of that city's payphones into hubs for wireless internet service. If it eventually does come to fruition, that plan would give the Big Apple the country's biggest public wireless network. But using payphones to actually, you know, make a call? Still apparently happening, and not only that, netting phone companies millions of dollars. Shruti Pinnamaneni went in search of the highest-earning payphone in Manhattan.
I find the payphone a few blocks from Times Square. It's the kind with a metal kiosk where you can lean in and hide your face. The payphone's been super busy all morning, just not for making phone calls. People use the kiosk to talk on cell phones, light cigarettes, count money. It offers a nook of privacy in a crowded city, says Stanley Shore, the NYC official who oversees payphone companies.
No other city had the payphones that we have. Verizon told me their second largest payphone market was Boston, and they had about 100 payphones.
New York has nearly 10,000.
What is it about New York City that made this?
We walk and talk a lot.
Last year, the city made $1 million from all those quarters used for phone calls. And that is just 10% of what payphone companies earn.
Oh my God, somebody's using payphone just when I was about to give up.
Can you tell me why you were trying to use the payphone just now?
Because my cell phone doesn't work.
Did the payphone work?
No.
That's right. The city's moneymaker payphone is broken. Which brings us back to logistics. The city doesn't install or repair payphones. That's the job of payphone companies. They spend about $60 a month on every phone. Nobody actually keeps track of who's using the phones, except for Mark Thomas.
It's everybody. It's like little kids. It's old people. It's well-dressed. It's shady-looking people. It's a lot of tourists.
Thomas knows because he's been taking photos of these people. For the past 20 years, he ran the Payphone Project, where he studied all aspects of public phones.
I actually love the smell of a filthy payphone. I've noticed sometimes you can smell a mix of maybe one man's cologne with a cigar or all these odd scents all sort of come together on a public phone.
It's 3:30 p.m. After hours of watching people not using the payphone, I meet this group of guys.
And so how often would you say use a payphone? Like every day?
Every other day.
Seriously?
I don't got a phone now.
His name is Wavy. At first, his coworkers don't want to talk to me. Wavy told them it was okay.
I'll tell you something. Well, that's been a drug dealer's dream. You're always selling drugs on the payphones.
This man's friends are not happy about his saying the word drugs.
Something about drugs? I'm sorry.
He puts on giant sunglasses and lets Wavy do the talking.
If I'm doing business, I'm going to use a payphone because I don't want nobody to get on my line.
The problem with using payphones for this kind of business is that sometimes your own customers get in the way.
Drug users who just try to break the phone so they could take all the money out.
The guy's advice to Mayor Bill de Blasio. Sure, put Wi-Fi in the payphone kiosks. Just don't forget to take out those tempting coin slots. In New York, city of payphones, I'm Shruti Pinnamaneni for Marketplace.
Cannes Film Festival wraps up this weekend. 2 weeks of director's cuts, storytelling and subtitles, and a whole lot of business being done besides. Wesley Morris writes on films for Grantland, and he is, of course, in the south of France this week. Wesley, good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kai. What's happening?
Well, nothing, but, you know, you're the one who's out running around. What is the vibe in Cannes this year? What's the big, the new thing?
It's pretty subdued. I mean, there is no real new thing. I mean, people have been mostly on their best behavior, except for people who like to crawl up people's dresses and that sort of thing.
Yeah, America Ferrera, we're not going there.
Yeah, we don't need to. Somebody already did. It's bad.
Oh, man. All right, we'll get to the movies in a minute, but there was something I wanted to ask you about. And you've been writing about this thing on Grantland. You've been writing about Cannes on Grantland. You seem a bit, what's the word? Well, underwhelmed, I guess, by the not only the quality of the films, but sort of the backstory of the commercialization of this whole thing.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a normal thing. You know, you come here every year and people think it's all art movies all the time by great directors. And that is definitely true. But one thing that is sort of a common thing that happens here is that it's also a marketplace. And it can be exciting if you're somebody looking to get a sale made for your little art movie or your giant crappy movie.
Do they do both there?
They do both. It is where gold and poo happily interface, because the language everybody speaks, obviously, is money.
Do a little compare and contrast for me, would you, between Cannes and Sundance, which everybody in this country thinks is, you know, the indie thing, and you go there for awesome movies and there's no commercialism. But of course, we all know there is.
Well, yeah, there definitely is. And I think the difference between the two festivals is that Cannes is a lot more upfront. There are movies here and people need to see them, and there has to be some sort of facility to get that to happen and get these movies in theaters all over the world. And this is the number one place to do that. All the money comes here for these 12 days, and anybody looking to get some of that money to either get a movie made or to get something distributed around the world, that's where this happens. And so, you know, if you've got a Salma Hayek project that she signed on to, you make a cheap little poster and you flash it around and you hope you can get some money.
All right. Quickly talk to me about Ryan Gosling. Hey, girl.
What can I say? His movie's terrible. I mean, I love and can watch almost anything. I found it very hard to love and watch this.
Wesley Morris, he writes on film for Grantland. He is in Cannes this week having all kinds of fun. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes on the way out today, two pearls of wisdom from big-time corporate CEOs. Pearl number one from Fiat CEO Sergio Marchionne. He's a tad upset about American regulations that oblige car makers to build a certain quota of battery-powered electric vehicles of their models. And speaking of the Fiat 500e, Marchionne says, and this is a quote, "I hope you don't buy it, because every time I sell one, it costs me $14,000, because I guess he can't charge enough to make up for it, so... okay, we won't buy any of those. Pearl number two from Chip Berg. He runs Levi Strauss & Company, famous, of course, for its blue jeans. Mr. Berg says that it's okay not to wash your denim garments, like ever. He's trying to save the world, which I get. Levi's has been upfront about wanting to cut back on the water used in the making of its jeans. Berg and Levi's says you can freeze them instead. That'll kill the bacteria and the smell, about which okay, but I don't think that's actually the way it works. So there you go. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Thursday. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.